Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water. Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself and reflect on these conversations. Hi everyone, it's Han from Full of Beans. This week I'm joined by Claire Steedman and Rachel Alderburn. Claire and Rachel are the founders of TEDS, which stands for the Eating Disorder Specialists. In this week's podcast, we talk about recovery and how TEDS work with their clients to determine what recovery might look like for them. We also talk about the challenges such as change and fear and how a client's identity, motivations and their values can be altered during their recovery. We also talk about new coping mechanisms and how to develop them, and speak about the process of EMDR as a therapeutic model. We do discuss eating disorder behaviours as usual, and so if this is something that you don't feel you can listen to right now, please know that this podcast will be ready when you are. With that in mind, let's get on with today's podcast with Claire and Rachel from TEDS.
Hello!
Hello,
Hello again. How are we?
Lovely to be back on the podcast, Hannah.
Yeah, just over a year since you came on last, which means that you guys are two now.
Yes, turning two in March. Yeah, another year on.
Yeah, because our birthdays do coincide, don't they?
Mine is the first.
Yes, we're really, really close. We should definitely have a joint party. That would be amazing.
When's your birthday?
So we are the...
Ours is the 23rd of March.
Oh, okay. That would work then. That would work. I feel like this podcast, I've had so many revelations. I mean, obviously we're talking about Full of Beans and Ted's birthday, but like there's been like three episodes where when I've started talking to people, it's been about their birthday, and I've realised that their birthday is also in January, like super close to mine. So I think this should be called the birthday podcast rather than...
I think it's amazing, isn't it, to think about. I don't know about yourself, but just to think about, the time has actually went really quick, you know, and you kind of keep pinching yourself that you've actually been, that it's been going for this long, you know, that you've kind of managed to establish something and then help it thrive and grow. And so yeah, I feel very grateful about it all, still being in existence and thriving.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant, you know, like to think just over
2 years ago, like, you guys were literally just starting out.
Mm.
You know, you'd come together knowing that the kind of treatment that you wanted to provide and thinking, we're going to do this. And you're still here. It's amazing. It's amazing. That's obviously what people need and what people wanted as well. So you're clearly doing it.
Thank you. I mean, it has evolved. And I think this is some of the things that we'll be talking about today in terms of how it's evolved and what we're still learning all the time, learning the process, learning what people need, meeting new people. They teach us as much as we kind of, you know, as we're supporting them. So we feel incredibly grateful.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, today we're going to talk about sort of working with clients. And do you call them clients?
We do, yeah.
I know that there's so many terms that people float around depending on what service or, you know, who you're working with. So I guess thinking about sort of working with your clients, what does recovery look like? You know, I'm sure that it looks very different for everybody, but how do you find out what recovery is going to look like for somebody when you take them on?
But I think you're absolutely right there, Hannah. Recovery is so individual. It really does depend on what someone deems recovery is going to be like in their life, depending on perhaps, you know, how long they might have had the eating disorder, in terms of if it's something that's been a part of their identity, if it's something that's been quite short-lived. It really does depend on that process there of what they're looking for. It might just be some stability. It might be, you know, what we would call as full recovery, where someone is really kind of free from the eating disorder and is living a full life and perhaps gone on to, you know, do things in career aspects or maybe have a family or, you know, something like that. So again, it really is really individual.
And the process is very, very subjective and very unique to each person. And I think that even the word like recovery, you know, you were connecting earlier, Han, about, you know, what do we kind of say about, are they your clients? What terminology do we use? And sometimes we can get really lost, I think, in language. And recovery is one of these things, isn't it, that's thrown around quite a lot. Oh, I'm in recovery. But it's a really messy, really subjective process. And it's not even really, I think, using the word encapsulates so much, you know, and it's so different for each individual. And I think what comes with recovery is whatever that person aspires to achieve, whatever their personal goals are, their aims. And I think it's also about a lot of it, and what Rachel and I were reflecting on recently, is that the actual process comes with a great deal of change. You know, people kind of enter in at the start, and after kind of going through the therapeutic, you know, process, at the end, there's been a lot of major life changes and transitions that have happened. And I think some people don't really expect that of recovery. You know, they just think, right, I want to recover from my eating disorder. I want to change these behaviours. I want to, you know, have a healthy connection with food and with myself and with my body. But actually, it's not about the foods, really. It's about someone working on themselves and their identity and making those changes, which means that that void is no longer there. It's not filled by an eating disorder, and it's filled by other things. And what comes with that is really, really huge life transitions. You know, we have clients who have, you know, if we reflect on the start of their process and where they are now, you know, there's been major shifts. People have changed vocations. They've changed relationships within their family or with significant others. People, they really have to shake things up. And I think that's something that's quite unexpected about recovery. You know, when you say that it does take, there's major life transitions that come with it as part of that process.
I think when we get inquiries that come through, we always do like a pre-assessment call with them just on the phone. Obviously we don't want to put people in for an assessment knowing that they're not right for a service or we're not what they might be looking for. And they're really interesting conversations with people. And just recently I was talking to a parent, and it's initially coming into therapy, there's a lot of preconceptions about what that might be. And actually it might be just like, okay, well, we'll get someone eating again, we'll focus on that, and then everything will be okay. But when you talk about what recovery means, like Claire said, it's not about the food, that's just the symptom of something underneath. That's what's, you know, it's what, how it's being presented. But you start working with people and, you know, the functions of it, the reasons why it's there in their life, you start thinking about, you know, why it came, why it's still maintained in their life. You start thinking about their sense of self, who they are, their values. Start working on all them levels and so much more comes to the surface. You start, you know, when you're working in the kind of model we do, looking at the past, the present and the future, it does take some time. And obviously once you've got to develop that rapport initially, you start then going down all these avenues and people do start to think, okay, well, is this actually what I want to do? Have I chosen all these things because I haven't felt like I've had a strong sense of self? They start to question things that they think that they might like or think they have wanted to do, or even relationships they might be currently in or from the past that they're still keeping, maintaining them relationships, and they might not be as healthy as they initially thought. All these kind of things that come up and then they start to reevaluate and reflect on. It's really hard to explain to someone that that might happen in this process. And that sounds a bit terrifying if you're telling someone that from the offset, because it's hard, really hard. But we definitely see that definitely people that we work with long-term, major transitions, just in, you know, in recovery, that process that we call recovery.
I think it's really interesting kind of that you've mentioned this, because it's something that I am recognizing a lot in my own recovery right now. And I think, you know, so often, and maybe this is like a stigma or like a, you know, a misconception about recovery, so often I think that people that don't have an eating disorder do think that eating disorder recovery is just about, you know, getting yourself back eating, being more flexible with food, you know, if you're thinking of anorexia, maybe gaining a bit of weight, that sort of thing. And they are obviously elements of it, but for me it's like 5% of it. And actually, you know, because I recently went on holiday with my mum, and you know, I was being pretty flexible with food and you know, kind of having what I wanted, and I was feeling really good. But it was actually the bigger picture of things, you know, the thoughts around it, my then compensatory behaviors, those actions. And so that to me made me realize, okay, this probably is the food, but it's not the food completely. But then also that idea of change. And I spoke to my mum so much about it on holiday, in that I've had an eating disorder since I was 12. So my whole stages of development have been completely engulfed in the eating disorder. And, you know, I was saying to her, like, I don't even know, like, my GCSEs, my A-levels, my university choices were based around my eating disorder. My music choices were because I was depressed. Like, it's, and so I think the thing that for me was then like, oh my God, was, okay, so not only am I being asked to eat more food, gain weight, which is terrifying, I'm literally being asked to question every single thing in my life as to, you know, do I like that? Is that friendship working for me? Is this relationship working for me? Like, do I actually want different things? Do I have different morals compared to what eating disorder is? And that, I think, brings a massive barrier up, because you're so used to your eating disorder just suppressing all those feelings and giving you those predefined answers. You know, okay, you're out for dinner, you will have the salad, that's what you're going to have. Or, you know, you're going shopping, you will buy this item of clothing, that is what you will have. So I guess in that whole sort of synopsis, when someone comes to you and they are ready to recover, and then you have to say to them, like, potentially there's going to be all these changes, how do you even begin to pick apart and navigate that with them? Because to me, that is what's really holding me back at the moment, is like, life is pretty crap with an eating disorder, but at least I'm not having to like flip everything upside down.
It's such a significant issue, isn't it? And I think it really is. I think the key thing, Hannah, is attachment with your therapist is really important. Having attachment, and we reflect on this a lot, is that, and I hope, you know, if our clients are listening to this, you know, that they all feel very attached to us, reflect quite a lot on how that can carry someone through those significant changes, those really scary changes. And obviously it's about attaching and then detaching, you know, allowing a client to then have the skills and resources, kind of being in that relationship, that therapeutic relationship with us, building that rapport. And what comes with that, Han, is like getting to know someone. So what you're saying about the identity issue, you know, being an illness almost, and that illness, if it's been there from an early age, kind of then tainting decisions and life, really, that's all contributed in your formative years to you being who you are right now. However, there will be parts that weren't. And I think that's a key focus of our work. Specifically, you know, I always hold that in mind, is I want to get to know who this person is. Now, there are cases where people have had this since they were 12, 9, you know, young, since they were children. However, there are parts that you can, if there is not a lot, based on that attachment, you can help someone explore who they are in the present and who they, you know, who they want to be in the future. And I think that's a key area of when anyone's looking for therapy and embarking on this big journey, because it is a big journey. It is significant. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. But if you have a really good attachment with a therapist or therapists in our case, and you feel held and you feel cared for and you feel seen, I think people can make all sorts of huge changes. And we see it. We have seen it. We are privileged to see it. You know, I feel so grateful. You know, some of our clients, the changes they're making or have made, you know, I think, wow, that is like fierce. Like, they're doing that. And we're right beside them, walking beside them, right there. And that takes, you know, this is where, yes, it's a huge process. It's life-changing, it really is. And yeah, it can be scary if you've lived with this for a long time and you're not quite sure where you start and where it stops. It's bloody. Mm. However, there will be parts of you that are you, particularly if you've been engaged with life. You know, like you've been to, you have been engaged, you have been exposed to things that are outside the eating disorders control, relationships, those kind of things, environments. And I think that is our job, really, to build that rapport, build that attachment and connection, and then explore, okay, who are you? Why is this here? What void does it fill in? And this is me kind of making it very kind of simplified, but why is this? Why did this come into your life? Why is it here? What function does it serve? And usually there's many. And then thinking about, okay, how can we replace those functions? But then what changes is that going to have to, what does that mean for you? And what does that mean for your life? Mm-hmm. And yes, that does then have a ripple effect. Because a basic example would be, for example, just say someone lacks assertiveness, quite passive. Just say, so a strand, and it wouldn't have been the whole cause, but a strand of it is that they can communicate their distress through the physical manifestation of distress, i.e. you know, not eating, kind of, they can communicate that way. So it has that function. So you work alongside someone, you figure out that that's one of the strands. You then help them develop assertiveness, communication skills. Inevitably, that might change their relationships, because they might have had friendship groups that were used to that person being passive and being the follower rather than the leader. Or they might be in a relationship, they might be in a kind of intimate relationship and might be a marriage, or, you know, since they were really young, you know, 17, 18, and now they're having to evaluate that and think about, okay, I've made these changes and it's not quite working. So this relationship has it now. These are the significant changes we're touching on, and that's a very, you know, I've picked out one strand. It's not that simple, but if you then make those changes, you're becoming closer to your true self, as in you, as an individual, and moving away from the illness. And that's the key thing. It's I think attachment with a good therapist, feeling held and seen. Exploration, who are you? And then making those steps, building, you know, learning those skills, making those changes with support, really. And actually, once what I have observed recently is the simple act of a person making a change, you know, just like leaving a relationship, or being assertive with a parent, or changing a job. The simple act of doing that, even just doing that, creates a benefit effect. You know, just making that change just gives someone that boost. Okay, this is me. I'm aligning myself with me. This feels like me. It doesn't feel like the illness. And it's all about helping someone align their actions with that newfound identity. Even if it's not secure, it's about then exploring what that might be. So then we can make it secure, so we can strengthen that sense of self. And then, yeah.
I think just to second that, Claire, as well, like the key thing you're talking about, that whole process is time, because obviously it's a very complex process. But I think building that relationship first will give you that good connection, that rapport that is essential. But then as you go through this process of starting to unpack, like Claire's just explained, that can be incredibly destabilizing. And I always use this analogy. It's a bit like going into a room, everything looks okay. But actually, there's really messy boxes. There's stuff behind doors, and it just doesn't feel, it doesn't feel tidy. It doesn't feel sorted. It feels just really overwhelming. And you start pulling out boxes. You start, you know, opening drawers and getting everything out. And before you know it, the whole floor is covered and it's a tip. And you think, why did I even cover the open them cupboard doors? Because now it feels even worse. That's the part in the middle that people start to go, oh, why did I start this? It feels worse. Why did I come into therapy? I'm absolutely terrified. And this has just made me feel horrible. It's that part that you have to start going, okay, let's take a breath. What we need to start doing is packing some of these things away, chucking some stuff out, you know. And once you start putting things in the right place, just very gradually, it does take time, but it will feel better when you start doing that. That's the kind of analogy that helps people sort of understand a little bit about that process, because it's scary in that time, in that middle bit.
And we often say, Rachel, don't we, and you know, when we're in sessions, like, we're on the floor with you. We're on the floor. We are on the floor with you, surrounded by this stuff. You're not on your own. And I find myself repeating that quite a lot in the week, is you're not on your own, you know, because sometimes people have been on their own for a long, long time. And because we all know that an eating disorder really isolates people kind of mentally. You might be surrounded by lots of people, but mentally you're trapped. You're trapped. It's you and it. And because it consumes you, you know. And I think we often, I find myself saying that a lot, is you're not on your own. And when we use that analogy, we're on the floor with you, and this is a mess, but we're together. You're not on your own. And I think these things can really help someone. It's, you have to, you know, with that attachment and connection, I think people can face a great degree of adversity and change that they need to make.
Yeah, I think that analogy is brilliant. I'm just imagining like a room that when you walk in, like you say, looks perfectly fine, but then you notice there's like something sticking out of the cupboard and you open it and it just all falls
away. Yeah.
And I think that is one thing that, you know, really when I first started therapy was something that I was struggling with, because I was like, at the moment, like it's all tucked away, it's all fine, like we're totally dealing with it. And it's like, yeah, but if there's a tiny gust of wind or like someone slightly knocks something, like that's when it all comes pouring out. So I think, you know, that analogy is brilliant. And I love the idea of you kind of coming down and being with people with that, because like you say, it can feel so lonely to go through recovery. And I think even, you know, to have somebody to just maybe like understand outside of, you know, your close family and friends. Because I think, you know, my mum is absolutely brilliant, and I will kind of harp on about that until the cows come home. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I will try and explain things to her, or I'll try and, like, you know, vocalize what my thoughts are. And it just, I can't get across the distress to her. And a part of me doesn't want to either, because, you know, I don't want to put that on her. But I think to have somebody understand and to realize sort of what is going on, is really helpful. And then the thing that you were saying about time as well, which is really funny, because I was speaking to one of the listeners last night, shout out to Helen, who is wonderful and sent me a lot of motivational pictures and things, so very grateful for Helen. And we were talking about how, you know, if you put a key in the car and you were scared of turning the car on, got all of that fear, but you turn the car on and it's on. And it's done, and it's like, okay, that was really scary. And yes, potentially I'm going to have to turn the car off, and then I'm going to walk away. But I've done it now. And because she initially used that analogy with eating disorder recovery, and that if you just turn the key on, then you know, you've done it, and then that anxiety will reduce, which I completely agree with, because the more that you do something, the more easy it becomes, and it doesn't fill you with as much anxiety. But I think the thing that gets me is that, you know, when you turn a car on, you get an instant like reaction to what you've done, like the car is now on. But with eating disorder recovery, there's no instant like either, you know, hit of like, oh, you've done that now, or it's not like, okay, well, you ate that donut and you gained a kilo, so therefore, you know, that dread has happened, that's what you thought was going to happen, but like at least it's happened now, we can deal with it. It's that like slow progress of you don't know actually what the outcome's going to be, but you've got to keep on doing it. And that's so scary, to keep doing something that is so terrifying and not actually know what's going to happen. And I think that for me is where the eating disorder then comes in, because if you just turned the car on and it's on, then the eating disorder doesn't have chance to be like, oh, you know, what could happen when the car turns on, blah, 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 blah. But when you are in recovery, because it's a prolonged thing and it happens slowly, there's so much more time for the eating disorder to keep being like, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. Like, oh my God, but what if this happens? Like, you can just stop now because you've done it a few times and you don't need to do it again. But it's that slow, continued, you know, keep adding on top of it that is so hard.
And I think another really important thing that you've just connected there, Hannah, is about the unknown, and that can often, the fear. So sometimes people, and someone conveyed this to us recently, is that they have the motivation, but it's the fear of the unknown that stops them. And what I often kind of reflect on is that you've done this, you know what life is like with an eating disorder, we know it, it's known, it's done. And what is it like? And generally it's horrendous, and I don't want to do it. So then I say, well, let's just give something else a go. And if that's horrendous, well, you've done this path, so you know it. So do something different. And it's got to be better than where you're at. It's just got to be, because you know this one. It's familiar, you know it. And there's safety in that, but it's also about, well, you don't know the other way. And if it is that bad, you know this route. So you know, so it's almost, you know, it's a bit of a challenge in a way, but it's saying to someone, well, you could go back, but be curious about doing something different before you just tread the familiar path. And I often talk about kind of, you know, like, well, I'm from Edinburgh, so I'm not a country girl, so. But you know, long grass, like if it's like wheat or something in a farmer's field, I'm saying, Rachel, help me out here. She's more country based, but you know, or maybe, but you know, long, when I describe this, I think my clients are like, that's Claire's from a city. I'm like, imagine this like long grass, wheat stuff. Yeah, I know it in my brain, but I don't know. And then I'll say, imagine that. And I think about things like, you know, because we all know that when people start to use positive coping strategies and replacement of negative ones, you know, so if someone's preventing a binge and they go out for a walk, or someone's gonna, you know, avoid eating breakfast, and instead of doing that they might do some journaling. You know, we're trying to actively replace negative coping strategies with positive ones. Now, just like what you're saying about the car, when you're doing that, it doesn't give that instant hit. It doesn't give the immediate gratification. Instead of missing breakfast, pulling out a journal doesn't give you that boost. Yeah, we've got to be real. We're very real and transparent. I think that's definitely our approach here at TIS, is we're just real. We name things as we see them. And I think this analogy I always use is, if you think about these neural pathways and things, you've been using these things for a long time, so they're very set in. So A happens, you get stressed, someone doesn't, you know, something happens, you go straight to not eating or being or whatever, binging or whatever the behavior is. And then the outcome is obviously that sense of all those emotions that come with it. Yeah. So what I always say is, when you're learning a new coping strategy, it's almost like you're looking at this field and it's got long grass, and there's these well-defined paths through this grass that you can see. And they're like not eating, over-exercising, you know, binging, whatever it is, that, okay, this trigger's happening, I need to run, I need to go, and I'm going down that well-defined path because I know how I get to the other side there. I can get to the other side through it. When you're learning a new coping strategy, what you're doing is you're stopping and you're looking at all those paths and you're like, I really need to try and not do that. And then what you do, which is on top of that, is you start to tread the new one. You walk down one and you're making a new path. You're trumping on all this grass and you're trying to make this new path. And that's really hard work, right? Because you don't know where it's going. You don't know where you're going. And you're not getting that instant run through to the other side. You're not getting that gratification, that immediate gratification. So it's that kind of delayed gratification, but you will get to the other side. And then once that path's defined and you've done it once or twice or three times, if you just keep doing that, do you know what will happen? Those roots that are well defined, the grass will grow over, and then you'll start using the ones that are defined. And that's a kind of way of thinking about the way our brains work in neural pathways, and then setting down. Because the more you do something, the more it will give you good that feedback, but immediately it won't. So these are really good kind of ways of kind of these analogies of explaining things, and I think instilling hope as well. But not being disgenuine, not kind of saying, oh yeah, just do it. You know, why are you doing that? It's not a good behavior. It's just do this. You actually have to say, yeah, this is tough. This is really tough. Mm-hmm. And actually we're not expecting you to be perfect. You might have days where you run down those well-defined paths, but if we can have some days where we're starting to tread these new ones and we opt to use these new ones as much as we can, then we're creating a change, aren't we? We're doing something different. And so then there's this openness and this curiosity for new things and a new way of being, a new way of existing, you know?
Yeah, I love that analogy. That it's like, so I mean, I think I'm a very like image-based person as well. So I can like see myself like hiking down those new pathways. And I think it's so important to be open and transparent with that, because, you know, so many times I've kind of been in services and they've said, you know, get me doing that. So yeah, that's not really like, you know, I understand that journaling will help me in the long run, cool, but when I am like completely in a mad panic about what I need to do, you just say to me, oh, just whack out your journal, as if it's really, you know, take a breath, or just eat or whatever, then it, you know, it really makes you feel like you just don't get it. But actually, you know, your honesty of, you know, the behaviours that you're using currently, they are really working for you, and, you know, they're giving you that kind of hit that you like, that you want. And these new behaviours won't, but in the long term, they really will. And I think that's something really important to recognise in eating disorder recovery, is that often the behaviours is because you do just want that, whether it's a sense of relief or a sense of pain, or, you know, just a sense of something that is quite overpowering. It's so important to recognise that that's what somebody's seeking, because, you know, I found putting new coping mechanisms in really difficult. because they don't give me that buzz that I need. And then you have to kind of sit with those feelings. And I think that's often the hardest part, is sitting with things. And one of my friends said to me the other day, that as part of her recovery, she's got to sit with emotions and work through them, because she uses her eating disorder to suppress her emotions. And she was like, you know, that's nothing to do with food. You know, sometimes I might have to sit when I'm feeling full and that makes me feel uncomfortable. But actually sitting with those uncomfortable emotions rather than going and, you know, doing an eating sort of behaviour, that for her is where it's going to be really difficult.
I think what we have to be mindful of as well is that what you just started off there with, Han, was that these stuff, when you're at a crisis point, when you're really overwhelmed, when you're highly anxious, when you literally don't know what else to do apart from leaning into the eating disorder and its behaviours, is that these interventions are going to be best served before you hit that point. It's almost like a traffic light system. So as soon as we start working with someone, we'll be saying, okay, let's put a couple of things in this week, see how they go. Just try them when you're not distressed. You know, when you're not about to go into a meal, or when you're not feeling more vulnerable, when it's not kind of, you know, all these trigger points, start practicing them on a daily thing. So they become, you know, you're treading that pathway before you're in that panic mode, before you're like so overwhelmed that actually you can't, then you don't have the capacity to start treading a new pathway when you're already desperate to run through the old one. So it is about practicing that, instilling that, knowing that what works and what doesn't. And as well as, you know, like Claire said, no one's perfect. We don't expect perfection from any of our clients. By all means, we're not perfect. No one is. And I think what is really helpful to learn is that we know that recovery isn't linear. So people are going to have bad days. People are going to still use eating disorders behaviours. The feelings aren't just going to disappear just because they're having eating their meal plan and, you know, not using compensatory behaviours or whatever it is that they might be doing. There are going to be them days where the eating disorder overrides it. But the thing is about that is that that doesn't mean they failed. That doesn't mean they're back to square one. That doesn't mean all is lost. That is a really powerful learning tool to use then. You can then look at that, reflect on it, process it. Okay, what was it that triggered you? What was it that you found so overwhelming on that particular day that there was no other option? What was it that you know, it hit from A to Z? What was the bit in between? And when you start reflecting on that, like you say, it depends on what that eating disorder behaviour was giving them at that particular time. So it might have been they were seeking comfort. It might have been they were feeling really out of control and actually they're trying to seek some control. It might have been that they wanted to punish themselves because they were feeling really awful inside. Whatever that is, you then have to think about what the corresponding coping strategy is for that. So, for instance, you know, if they're feeling just so overwhelmed and high, it might be something that we're looking at, right, okay, let's think about something that might give you sensory feedback rather than like, oh, I need to go for a run. Like, okay, right, let's think about holding ice. Let's think about flicking a rubber band. Let's think about, you know, the Jacobson technique of like, you know, tensing body parts and releasing them. Again, they're not going to give you that instant hit, but it's practicing that, knowing which coping strategy to put in for what you need at that particular time, and knowing when you're reaching amber point before you reach the red and putting that in place.
And I think as well, what's really important to note is that, and I've just kind of thought, reflected on this just now, is that as a therapist, part of the attachment in getting to know someone, you're able to almost intuitively select or suggest coping strategies that would stand in for the ones that someone's using, negative ones. So often, for example, you know, if we have clients that self-induce, you know, vomit, what I've often found is, you know, I'm just thinking about a couple who come to mind, and I've just had a feeling that they need physical feedback. You know, they don't need to sit and journal. They need to perhaps, you know, throw a ball at a wall, or they need something more physical as opposed to something more sedentary. Or and I think that's another kind of, it comes from obviously, I think, experience as a therapist, but I think it comes a lot from just intuition and attachment with your client, with people. because you again, getting to know them, them trusting you, you trusting them, and having that really good core attachment, you get to know them, and you almost get a feeling or an intuition about what might work for them as a stand-in. Mm. And that's something that I've only just recently started to reflect on, is that there's certain, after building that therapeutic relationship, rather than me pulling out a kind of textbook and going, right, okay, try journaling, try having a bath, try going for a walk and do the five senses technique. Try to, instead of doing that, I've actually used my knowledge, my connection with the person and my awareness of them and who they are, and maybe those little bits of identity, and obviously knowing the reasoning why they're being pulled towards that negative coping strategy, and then finding a really apt and unique replacement for that, which what you were connecting before that, people just saying, yeah, just eat, you know, or just pull out a journal. Mm. It, there's a part of that really upsets me, because it's not authentic, really. If you have a really good connection with a client, you know, you're able to suggest things that really might cut it, but obviously it's going to take time.
Yeah, I think in the same way of like how we were saying, you know, everyone's eating disorder is unique and everyone's recovery is unique, like giving coping mechanisms is really good, but I think there then comes a thing of like, oh, well, that one didn't work for me, so, you know, maybe recovery is just not for me because that coping mechanism didn't work. And I have gone through so many different coping mechanisms of, you know, people saying, oh, this really worked for me, you should try it, and then you try it and you're like, it's not giving me what I need. One thing I found, which I mean maybe people have mentioned it, I've just not really heard it, plaiting my hair. So I will like go for a shower, and the shower I think gives me that like sensory, you know, like just taking my clothes off, feeling quite free, and the warmth of the shower, making sure that I keep like the temperature regulated and stuff like that, and then getting out of the shower, and obviously I have a lot of hair, so it will take a very long time, so I can spend many an hour plaiting my hair. And I think it's doing something with my fingers. I think because I'm doing something with my fingers, I can't actually do anything else. Often I'll like put music on or something, but I shouldn't say this because I am a podcaster, but maybe not listen to a podcast because it's sometimes a bit too much, but that's just my personal preference. But that's taken me quite a while to sort of think about. And I think the one thing that I found as well is because I am doing something with my hands, but not necessarily with my head, kind of linking into what you said, Rach, of like, it actually gives me time to think, okay, so I really wanted to go and exercise and I haven't. I've gone for a shower and I'm now plaiting my hair. Why did I want to exercise?
Yeah.
And so rather than like not engaging in the behavior and just not engaging in the behavior and trying to learn from not engaging in the behavior and be like, you know, why did I want to do that? What was it that made me feel like I needed to exercise? Was it that I'd eaten and I felt uncomfortable? Was it somebody said something that made me feel uncomfortable? But again, it's, you know, it's such a slow process, and you have to do that so many times to then feel comfortable in doing that. And then one day I'll be sat plaiting my hair and be like, oh my God, this is not it. So just because it's worked one day doesn't mean it's going to work another. So I think it is so complex, but it sounds like you guys really understand that, and it's so refreshing to hear that you do.
And a lot of the time what we have to say is that if you can hold on for a little while, feelings do pass. They might be so intense and so difficult at that time, but that urge to be sick or that urge to exercise or that, you know, wanting to restrict or whatever it is, it does pass. I'm not saying it all goes away completely, but and also sometimes distraction's great, brilliant, a really helpful tool. But if you're always, always distracting, you're never actually going to give yourself enough space to sit with any distress. So you're not going to be managing, you're not going to be able to regulate your own emotions, you're not going to be able to know what works, what doesn't. There is a level of distress that we do encourage, if it's the right time and we feel they can tolerate that, that we do encourage our clients to feel, because an eating disorder is fantastic for absorbing your emotions, not having to sit and feel anything. And also something, you know, like, for instance, being sick is, a very aggressive thing to do, but it's a state change. It's an emotional state change, and it's very quick. It's short-term relief, and it's, you know, and then all the other kind of more difficult feelings might come after that. But if you can find something that, that does work in that interim and let that pass, it will do in time.
So, yeah, I want to move on to EMDR and kind of the process of change, and because that was one thing I found was that a lot of overwhelming change happened, and sometimes it was really overwhelming, and, you know, my therapist would be like, the next 72 hours are going to be hard, and I'd be like, yeah. So really excited to speak to you about EMDR. So for the listeners, do you mind, I guess, firstly, just kind of telling us what EMDR is and how the process works?
Yeah, so EMDR, short for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is clear why people shorten it down, because that is horrible to say. So what it is, it's a psychotherapy tool. And again, it is generally something, it is a standalone therapy if that's what you choose to do. But what we choose to do with it is implement it into our already standing approaches. So, for instance, if we were introducing EMDR into, say, after we've built that rapport, we've got a good connection with our clients, and we're starting to do that initial exploratory work of, you know, looking at the past a little bit, seeing where they are and how that informs their present at the moment. And then if we're starting to find that perhaps there's trauma that they've experienced and that might have contributed to the onset of the eating disorder and still maintain it, or not necessarily even trauma itself, it can be, just as an overview, I think was what you were asking, Han, is that EMDR was initially something that was used for like post-traumatic stress disorder, like veterans and things like that, but it has evolved since then, and it can be now used is a really multifaceted tool across all different mental health, phobias, anxiety, eating disorders, body image, things like that. So what we found is we don't use it with everyone. It's something that we get to know our clients and start to think if they could benefit from that. And again, it's if we know there's a straightforward trauma there, or multiple traumas, or a cluster of traumas is what we call them, if they're within the same kind of area, it would seem like the one of the kind of routes that we would follow down. But we would also, because of the way we work in that combined way, for instance, Claire might be working with EMDR in one session, and then the second session that they'd have with me within the same space, I might be then be working on something like just checking in with them, a holding space, a space where they can kind of reflect on their week and process anything, or, you know, just to kind of keep that containment and stability going.
Rachel, let me just interject. Rachel's got very good occupational therapy skills now.
she comes from working with a very good occupational therapist for many years.
I suppose the nuance there is, I think that because we do see people twice in 1 week, so they get one session with Rachel, one session with me, if we do feel that EMDR is appropriate, one session would be based on that, because it is obviously a very structured approach. And it doesn't give space for people to reflect and think about the present, because, as you know, Han, you've experienced it. Rich and I have obviously experienced it. We've practiced it, because when you train with an EMDR, you practice it in a training environment. You go through the process yourself and you administer it on other clinicians to practice. And it is very, very structured. So it's a process in itself, and it's a very kind of, it's a standardized procedure. So there's no room for people to log on and say, oh, I've had a really difficult week, I've been really struggling with this behavior. You have to use the whole space, because the recommended session for EMDR is 90 minutes. We have 60 minutes. So, it, you know, even with 90 minutes, you can do a big check-in. So it does kind of mean, but I suppose me and Rachel feel, have found that naturally and intuitively, one of us takes a more structured approach in the week and the other one then takes a more free-flowing approach in the week. And that's just something that intuitively, again, we're adapting to what the clients need. But I'm sorry, I interjected there, Rachel, were you explaining EMDR? But...
No, that's not a problem. It made me laugh. And equally, Claire's a very good psychotherapist as well now. we have to be mindful. We do know about our boundaries and qualifications, but we do have a really good understanding and knowledge because we work so closely together.
Something that I wanted to pick up on just before you do explain it is the idea of trauma, because that was something I really kind of struggled with when I went for EMDR, because obviously started seeing the word trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder all over the place, and I was like, well, I haven't had any trauma.
Yeah,
like, you know, my life has been pretty idyllic. You know, I've got great parents, great siblings, you know, always been in a friendship group, you know, not had anything drastic happened. And I was like, why the hell am I being told to do EMDR? Like, not, well, I guess maybe there was like a, I'm not worthy of it because I'm not, you know, I've not had a bad enough life or whatever. So I think if you could maybe explain a little bit more about that as well, because what I came to realize was that whilst I hadn't had any sort of like physical trauma, the emotional trauma of being inside my body was what came up for me so much. You know, when we went through the EMDR, it was massively the feelings of sitting in my body that came up for me. And that was what I had to reprocess.
That's a really good point, Hannah. I don't know how many times I lose count of how many times people said to me, I haven't suffered trauma. And when you start to reflect and you say, you kind of say to them, and you have to be careful about this because trauma is a big word. It feels really significant for some people that, again, they don't think they've experienced trauma. When you're saying to them, actually, that is traumatic. I think you have experienced trauma. That can feel massive and that can feel really, again, destabilizing because they think, what? You know, so you're absolutely right. Trauma doesn't necessarily just mean, oh, you know, I've been in a really traumatic accident, or, you know, I've had some level of abuse, or, you know, I've been in a huge earthquake where lots of people died. Not, it doesn't necessarily mean a huge traumatic experience like that, but it can be what we call these big T's and little T's. So these kind of smaller T traumas are everyone will have suffered one or at least multiple ones of them over their lives, even to the point where we think about something like grief. And again, everyone in the life will have suffered grief or will suffer grief at some point. And it's a normal human process, but it can be a really traumatic experience for someone. And again, it's like you've just pointed out, it's the trauma of being inside your own skin. Like, even the process of having an eating disorder is traumatic in itself. So we do have to explain that word trauma, of what that means to people, and to go gently with
and
that.
And I think on reflection, that is a process in itself before you even, with a lot of clients, that you, again, we're talking about these kind of really emotive fueled words, aren't we, that are quite ambiguous, because it's all about how they're applying to the individual in front of you, like recovery or trauma or, you know, these things. And trauma is very subjective to the individual, and I think when we start to talk about trauma with clients, that often is a process that you were connecting with, Hannah, about, well, that isn't, you know, I can't connect with that being traumatic. That wasn't traumatic. Because people kind of view, again, trauma as a significant event, like an event you can put your finger on, or a really significant, you know, like a big term, like that was kind of physical abuse. You know, people are looking for these big, big events, and it's not, that's not the case. You know, and actually another interesting angle, which is kind of off, well, it's on topic but off, is that you know, if we think about someone with autism, for example, you know, there was when I was doing my training in EMDR, there was a lot of talk about, is EMDR appropriate for individuals who are autistic? And we were talking a lot about how everyday life is traumatic for people with autism. You know, there's a lot of trauma that maybe a neurotypical person wouldn't experience that someone who's more neurodivergent would. So again, it just brings it down to really the basics, is that trauma is very subjective. If something's been traumatic for you, it's been traumatic for you. And I think thinking about how we explain this to our clients, the process. Now, I feel under a bit of pressure because your EMDR therapist did the Ribena explanation, and that's a fantastic one. I'm really sorry, Hannah. I'm really boring. I'm very geeky. I give very boring explanations of EMDR because I'm very like you. I love research. I'm very kind of, so, you know, the understanding really is that you have trauma is unprocessed. That's why. So it's almost like fragments in the brain that are lying around. And events that can happen can kind of trigger those things off, those unprocessed traumas, those unprocessed memories. Because they haven't been properly processed and organized in your brain. So how I kind of explain it is that you have this, you've been through something that's been traumatic, and because you were under so much distress when it was happening, the part of your brain, the amygdala, was in a really heightened response, and actually I think it enlarges. So what happens then is that memory cannot be processed and properly stored and packed away and filtered into and connected with other memories. So for example, when you're recalling a negative event, you know, something that happens at work and you're like, oh, this happened to me before in that job. And what did I do there? That's an example of a negative event that's been properly stored, that's really nicely stored in your memory that you can access and learn from. It's not traumatizing. So I remember when my boss did that, it wasn't nice. Oh, what did I do in that situation? I did this. That's that example. However, when the amygdala is really aroused, that memory, that event cannot be passed to the hippocampus, and it can't be then organized and neatly stored and connected and become a past event then. It's almost like you're reliving it now and again if something triggers something off. So something that hasn't been processed, a trauma that hasn't been properly processed, is then just lying there, and it's almost very vulnerable, and it can be triggered at any given time. And that's what makes it feel like it's happening now rather than it was a past event. So what we do in EMDR is, the idea behind it is, you keep the prefrontal cortex online. So you keep someone present, and that's what happens when you do bilateral stimulation. So when you do the tapping or you do the eye movements, you're keeping the part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, online while someone's processing that trauma, which keeps the amygdala, it doesn't get as heightened or enhanced. So it then means that that memory, through the process of keeping someone online in the present, can be then passed through to the hippocampus and then stored eventually. That's my geeky way of explaining EMDR. It's super geeky and boring, right? It's nothing like whoever your therapist is. We need connection needs to give me some creativity, because but that's the idea, right? That's how we kind of explain it, is that, you know, because traumas are things that when they get triggered, it feels like you're in them right there, right then. Whereas if you think about that past event that wasn't very nice, and you can think about it and not feel like it's happening to you now, that's a sign it's been processed properly. So through the process of EMDR, keeping that prefrontal cortex online, through the bilateral stimulation, just the eye movements, the tapping, you're then calming the amygdala down, allowing it to go to the hippocampus and for it to nicely do its job and get it all stored away, a little bit like that analogy with the room, tucking things, putting things in the right boxes, connecting things up.
It really helps to see how it can work for eating disorders as well, if you've got that unprocessed, you know, whatever it has been that you then lean in to use the eating disorder to sort of navigate, because you've got that unprocessed situation, the eating disorder becomes the thing that you use. Whereas when you're then able to process whatever's happened, you don't then necessarily need to lean into the eating disorder to kind of just numb everything down, because you've got the ability to be like, okay, yeah, this has happened, it's okay.
And I think that the interesting thing about EMDR, because obviously we can't go into great detail, but you know, and maybe a lot of listeners won't know about what I mean by bilateral stimulation, like the eye movements and tapping, but essentially the process is very heavily structured. If we're wanting to talk about how it feels, I think clients would say that it's very structured. It is kind of standardized. So, and as a therapist, there's techniques that you use to kind of help with the processing of the trauma. And once it is done, because really the theory is that it's the brain's, you're allowing the brain to do, you're enabling the brain to do naturally what it can do on its own. So as a therapist, you aren't really doing much apart from facilitating this process, which actually for a client is quite mind-blowing, because they're thinking, I haven't sat here for 10 weeks and reflected on that trauma and are feeling different. I've sat with you for maybe a couple of sessions. You've wiggled your hands in front of my eyes, or you've made me tap myself, and now I'm not feeling like that's as triggering. And I actually think this is a really important thing to note, is that for a therapist, when you start to learn and be part of the EMDR, you have to kind of shut up and you have to kind of contain yourself, because you're so used to intervening. But actually, all you're doing is allowing the brain to do what it naturally does. So you have to just trust in that, which is pretty amazing, actually. It's an amazing kind of skill to have as part of our skills at, you know, at TEDS. But clients feel really in awe of it. You know, often they finish a session, they go, I don't think that, did that really happen?
That's really weird.
People that maybe, you know, came out of an EMDR session with Rach, and they came to me a couple of days later and went, I still can't believe I'm not feeling as distressed about that. And it's a very kind of, you know, you spoke about hypnotherapy, you know, when Rachel was training it, I remember I used to say, oh, don't talk to me, you know, you're going to end up hypnotizing me. You're going to make me do it, you know. Because actually it is a pretty magical process. But actually I think it's just because as therapists, you're trained to kind of analyze, reflect, you know, and be very attached and connected and kind of overanalyzing and over and facilitating. Whereas with this, it is a very standardized process, and you're just sitting back, doing what you need to do, allowing the client to just, the brain to do what it naturally can do, kind of thing.
And there is one thing I'll interject there, is that it's a three-pronged approach as well. So you are looking at kind of past triggers, traumas, you know, you're looking at present-day triggers, things like that, and you're potentially looking at kind of future templates and things about what potentially their fear might happen in the future, you know. So it's a really well-rounded tool. But again, when you're talking about eating disorders, the complexity comes into it again, because there's still a lot of fear, there's an ambivalence there, and it's not a quick fix. You might start one particular thing in a session, and you might go, wow, great, processed it in one session or two sessions. But that's just one tiny little bit of the picture. It's not just, you know, someone came in and said, nothing to do with eating disorders. Someone said, I had a car accident. You process it in one session and it's like a single trauma and it's great. Okay, fab. I'm now not scared to get in a car. Brilliant. But because we know that eating disorders are so complex and so multifaceted, you have to really go carefully about all the different parts and elements and the targets that you're using. For instance, research proves that trying to use EMDR for body image is really difficult. Because again, you're having to navigate through lots of kind of past, present, and future kind of thoughts, as well as, you know, it becomes quite challenging. But again, what we do say is we found it incredibly helpful as a tool, but also that fits in with other approaches that we use, because again, it's not one fix fits all.
It's interesting that you say that, actually, because that's exactly what I used it for. I used it for body dysmorphia. And, you know, I think you're so right in what you say, in that it takes a lot. Like, I had weeks and weeks and weeks of like nothing was changing.
Yeah.
I'd go and I'd be unconsciously crying. Like, I'd have my eyes closed and I'd be tapping, and I'd just be like, my eyes were just like completely bawling out. But then, you know, I'd still have all of those feelings, and then all of a sudden it clicked.
Yeah.
And if I hadn't have kept going and, you know, stayed on it, you know, thinking, oh, I'm going to have this magic cure today and I'm going to be sorted, then I don't think it would have worked. But because I had faith in the approach working, I could feel, you know, those hours afterwards of things kind of reprocessing and stuff like that. It was a very overpowering. I think if I had to describe it in one word, it would be overwhelming.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I used to, if I had a session, I would say, okay, I can't have any plans for 72 hours, because if I had gone through something, I remember there being a time where I'd like gone through a particular event and then I had a panic attack. In the same sense that I did, like 48 hours afterwards. And I was like, I need to be in like a safe space for that. So it is a very overwhelming experience, but the effects of it can be so powerful.
Yeah.
And I would say now I don't have body dysmorphia, which I never thought that I'd get.
Yeah, that's amazing. Absolutely amazing. I think the prep work's incredibly important as well, Han, when popped into my head, in terms of, you know, people who have eating disorders, body dysmorphia, can be really disconnected to their bodies. So in the process of the assessment phase, when you're doing EMDR, you're asking people to connect on an emotional level, like on a cognitive level, and on a really physical, semantic level as well. And when someone's struggling to really know what that is, or even inside their own body, when you start to, you know, really try to get them to connect with that, they find it so hard and they don't really understand what you're asking them to do. So there is a lot of prep work as well in terms of emotional, just people really being able to engage within their own bodies and understand what their emotions are and what's coming up. So that kind of history taking and preparation phase is crucial, which is what we kind of do the history taking in our other modalities anyway, to get to know them first, which is an incredible privilege, because we don't just come in and then have to do all that history taking just in the kind of format of EMDR. Really incredibly, you know, grateful that we get to flex to the client, which, you know, is it's a really helpful way of working.
Well, thank you both so much. I think this episode has been so useful, thinking about the process of recovery and the difficulties. Often I think we forget about the sort of length that recovery can take and the difficulties that we might face. So I think it's really important to reflect on those. Where can people go to find out more?
So we've got our website. I mean, we're on the Beat Help Finder as well, so people can get us from there. But and then we've got social media and things like that, you know, and Instagram, and
they're all on the website. All the handles for each one are all listed on the website, so you'll be able to access our blog there, our, you know, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter are all on there. So we're everywhere. Come find us.
Amazing. No, it's been a pleasure to speak to you both again. So thank you very much for joining.
Thank you, Han. It's lovely as always. Thank you for your time.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe.
Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.